Today's podcast is sponsored by Indeed. Indeed knows hiring needs to be cost-effective when you're running your own business. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply. Today's podcast is also sponsored by NetSuite, the easy-to-use cloud-based business management software for every aspect of your business. Take advantage of NetSuite's special financing offer at NetSuite.com/gold. So I don't forget later in the podcast, I want to let everybody know that the plan is for me to be a guest on the Laura Ingraham Show on Fox News tomorrow night. The show airs from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and it will be a live appearance. Now, sometimes I promo these appearances, and I end up not being on. It is the intention of the producers and Laura to have me on. But you never know, because that's a live program. If there's some breaking news, it's possible that you tune in and I'm not there. But hopefully, if all goes according to plan, I will be there. So I would encourage people to tune in and watch me. You know, if I get a ratings boost, these networks will have me on more often if they see more people tuning in to hear me. Also, I wanted to correct something I mentioned on the last podcast about the Money Show. I'm going to be at the Money Show in Miami on April 10th. And I initially said that it was free because every Money Show I've ever been to has been free. But I haven't been there in a few years. So it's a rare appearance for me to go back. And I actually had some other things I'm going to be doing in the Miami area. So it kind of worked out. But I found out that they actually are charging money now. I mean, this is another result of inflation. This kind of thing doesn't even show up in the CPI. You know, when something that was free all of a sudden costs money, that doesn't even make it in because it never was there to begin with. But it now costs, apparently it's $249 to get a ticket, although there's an early bird special if people register now for $199. But if you want to go, I've arranged $50 off if you sign up at the website that they set up for me. It's shift.moneyshow.com. So you can get $50 off the early bird special if you want to go down there. Now, there's a few things that I want to talk about on today's podcast. One being the 60 Minutes appearance of Jerome Powell. You know, it's getting to be a regular recurring event, right, that the Fed chairman goes on 60 Minutes. And, of course, he gets treated a lot better than 60 Minutes treated me. You know, he's not going to have to sue and win for defamation like I did. But I'm going to talk about what Powell said. Then I'm going to talk about what President Trump said. He was interviewed also over the weekend by Maria Bartiromo of Fox Business. And so I want to talk about that. And then I also want to talk about today's SEC announcement, which is something that I kind of spoke about on one of the podcasts that I did over the summer when I was in Europe. And I kind of saw this happening, and now it's happened. So I want to talk about that because it's a negative development. But before I get into that, I want to mention gold again because, you know, gold dropped about $20 an ounce yesterday, although it recovered about half of that decline today. But of course, as soon as gold goes down, you know, the gold stocks get hammered. They're down 3-4% again. The sentiment is just so negative in these names. And we've had a lot of these $20 or more sell-offs in the price of gold, which has, you know, scared the hell out of the gold stock market. But what I pointed out today on X, and something that nobody is really talking about, but even though gold went down a lot, I mean, not a lot, I mean, $20 isn't that much, but even though it has these big drops, gold has not gone below 2,000 in 37 days. That means that gold hasn't traded below 2,000. I'm talking about spot, not even the futures, which trade a little higher. But there hasn't been a single day in 2024 where gold has been below 2,000. I mean, think about that. And 37 consecutive days above 2,000, that's a record. You know, the prior record was 11 days above 2,000, and that was in late 2023. So kind of not too far before this record. It was almost like a string, but there were a few days in between that we got below 2,000. But we've now been above it again for 37 straight days. But if you think about what that means for the price of gold, I think in the entire history of gold, there have only been 29 days where gold traded above 2,000. And in the past, when it got to 2,000, maybe it stayed there for a day, in, you know, 3-4 days. That was it until that string, I think, in 2023. So it was very rare for gold to even get above 2,000, let alone maintain a price above 2,000. But that's what's happened. And to me, this former resistance area where everybody wanted to sell $2,000 gold has now become support, where the smart money is buying the dips to 2,000. Now, yes, we haven't made a lot of headway north of 2,000, but we haven't gone south. And what's happening is consolidation. Yes, there are still people who want to sell gold above 2,000, but I think the number of sellers is getting smaller and the amount of gold that they have to sell is getting smaller. At the same time, more and more buyers are stepping up and they're not waiting for breaks below 2,000. They're buying the breaks to 2,000, but they're buying before it gets to 2,000. So to me, this is a very bullish sign of a tremendous amount of support being built at a level that used to be resistance. And we're gonna squeeze the overhead resistance out. The sellers are ultimately gonna be gone for the market. And I think the price is just gonna take off. And it's amazing to me that gold has never really looked this good, technically, fundamentally, yet the sentiment for the mining stocks has probably never been this bad. You know, I get emails all the time. Clients are frustrated on the gold stocks. You know, when are they going to go up? I mean, people are expecting, with all this positive news, people expect these stocks to be much higher. And of course, with the price of gold holding above 2,000, because, you know, a lot of my clients have been buying these gold stocks since gold was under $400, right? Right? It's at 2,000. And yeah, it should be a lot higher than 2,000. Now, part of the problem is that the cost of mining are also a lot higher now than they were when gold was at 400. In fact, none of the gold companies that were mining gold back then could even be in business today if the price hadn't gone up, because the cost went way up. And again, that's the irony, that gold stocks are the ironic victims of inflation. Inflation has driven up mining costs. But because investors still don't realize how bad the inflation problem is, the price of gold hasn't risen nearly enough to reflect it. And so that's been a problem for these mining companies. But as far as I'm concerned, it's actually been a blessing for investors. I know it's frustrating if you've owned these stocks for a while, but don't worry. You're going to, I believe, make up for it in the end. The reason it's a blessing is I've had a lot of new clients that have come on board in the last several years, and they're lucky that they have the opportunity to buy these stocks at the prices that they're at. And even older clients who have more money now have an opportunity to add to their positions, which is what I have done personally. I'm very surprised that, given all that's happened, I'm still able to buy some of my favorite names at the prices that they're at, because, you know, I got to do something with my money that I'm earning. And so this is a great opportunity for me. But I just wanted to point out, no one really talks about the fact that gold has spent so much time above 2,000 and how bullish a sign that is for the market. So again, you know, buying physical gold and silver, you know, it's even more bullish for silver, because if gold's going to take off, which, you know, it looks like it will, there's no way silver is going to get left behind.
In fact, eventually it's going to cash up and overtake gold because that's what it always does. I mean, again, you know, just because it's done it, you know, in the past doesn't guarantee it's going to do it in the future. But history is generally a pretty good guide because it's really all we have, right? We don't know what's going to happen in the future, but we know what has happened in the past. And we could use that as pretty much our only reference to try to extrapolate and decide what we think is the most likely thing to happen in the future. And I think that's that ultimately that you're going to see an even bigger move up in silver, especially since it's now, you know, half of its record highs, whereas gold is basically at an all-time record high. Yeah, technically it's been a little higher, but for government work, it's pretty much at the highs, and silver is, you know, half its highs. So I think, you know, while you're buying some gold, make sure and buy some silver. And again, you know, the mining stocks, they're giving these things away. I know, I mean, it's not like the toy inside a Cracker Jack box, but it's pretty close. But yeah, I mean, there's risk, but there's risk in everything. The key is, what is the risk in relation to the upside potential? That's the key. Yeah, I could lose money if the gold stocks go down, but you could make a hell of a lot more money if they do what I think they're going to do. And the fact that you can already buy them this cheap, I think, de-risks a lot of the trade. Yes, there's still risk in there, but the stock should be much higher in price right now, given where gold is, you know, technically and fundamentally. So that takes some risk out of the trade. But anyway, so I want to get started, though, talking about the Powell pilgrimage to 60 Minutes, which now seems to be an obligatory rite of passage, although he's been on before, right? But, you know, I think it was Ben Bernanke. I think that was the first time. I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, I didn't really research it to find out if, you know, Alan Greenspan, yeah, maybe he was on 60 Minutes. I can't even remember. But I remember Ben Bernanke on 60 Minutes. I remember watching that, and I remember writing a commentary about it. It was in 2009. I didn't do a podcast back then. I didn't do my radio show. But I used to write a lot and publish my writings online and send them out to a bunch of websites. And, of course, I was going on, you know, cable news and talking about Bernanke. But the most significant thing that he said in response to the questions about all of the money that was created, you know, in the aftermath of the beginning of the financial crisis and the collapse of Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and AIG and Fannie and Freddie and all that stuff, right? And launching of quantitative easing, slashing interest rates down to zero, all that stuff that happened. And he goes on 60 Minutes to explain this to the country, like, you know, what's going on. And he reluctantly admitted, or maybe even not so reluctantly, that they were printing money, because he was asked, and I forget who the guy was that interviewed him on 60 Minutes, but he said, hey, you know, who's going to have to pay for all this, right? Is it going to be the taxpayer? I mean, you know, all these bailouts, all this stimulus, all this money, right? Are we going to have to pay taxes? And he said, no, it's you know, no one's going to have to pay any taxes because we're just printing money, right? So that means, hey, it's free, right? Nobody has to pay for it because we're basically printing money. I mean, he said it's more akin to printing money, because he said we're not really printing it. We're just creating entries on a keyboard. We're just magically adding numbers to the accounts of the banks. But he said it's effectively printing money. Anyway, I'm going to continue to talk about this. It's important and it's relevant to what Powell said on this Sunday. But we got a quick commercial. We'll come right back. So don't go anywhere.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messages so you can contact with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agreed Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join the 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. What I love most about Indeed is how simple it makes the hiring process and allows you to do all your hiring in one place. Candidates you invite to apply are three times more likely to actually apply for your job than the candidates who see it in search alone, according to US Indeed data. Indeed gets you one step closer to the hire by immediately matching you with quality candidates. And now, listeners of my show can get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Just go to Indeed.com/Peter right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, then you need Indeed.
All right, I'm talking about Ben Bernanke's 2009 60 Minutes appearance. And so when he admitted that the Fed was printing money, he at least had enough integrity to be a bit ashamed or embarrassed about the fact that they were doing that. And he told the audience, America, that this was an emergency measure, that the Fed only did this because of the nature of this emergency, and that it was temporary. And he said, don't worry. When this emergency is over, as soon as the recovery begins, and he didn't even say when the recovery ends or like halfway through it. I mean, I actually took a small clip from the 60 Minutes appearance from 2009, and I posted it on X. So if you look through, you know, my X page over the last few days, you'll see that clip. It's about a minute and 20 second clip that's up there. And so when he's admitting this, he said, look, don't worry. We know this is unorthodox, right? This is, you know, banana republic kind of, you know, money printing. We know this is a bad thing. But, you know, these are very, very difficult times. This is a 100-year flood. I mean, we would never do this under ordinary circumstances, but they're so extraordinary, right, that these desperate times, right, call for desperate measures. And so, yeah, we printed money, and we bought government bonds, we bought mortgages, we bailed everybody out. But don't worry, because as soon as this recovery begins, right, and the emergency is over, we are going to reverse all this. We're going to unwind quantitative easing. We're going to shrink our balance sheet. We're going to raise interest rates, and we're going to shrink the money supply because we want to make sure that we don't end up with inflation. So he knew back then that the consequence of the policy, unless he could unwind it, unless the Fed can reverse the process and shrink its balance sheet back down to where it started and reduce the money supply, right? Suck out all that extra money that was pumped into the economy. In other words, deflation. When the Fed printed all this money, it was creating inflation. What it needed was to deflate, to reverse the process. And Ben Bernanke admitted that, and he told the 60 Minutes audience that's what the Fed was going to do. Now, I remember when he said that, and I responded, and I said, look, I don't know whether he's lying, right, or he actually believes this, but I said back then, it ain't going to happen because it's easier said than done, because you can't create an economy that is addicted to cheap money and then, you know, take away the cheap money. It's like we're going to get this guy hooked on drugs, and then just when he's, you know, really starting to like it, we're going to take the drugs away. No, you guys going to go into convulsions, right? Withdrawal. I knew the problem in 2008 was that we had too much debt. why did we have too much debt? Because the Fed kept interest rates too low for too long, and there was a debt bubble that burst. And of course, when the debt bubble bursts, you know, you get the financial crisis, you get a lot of losses. What was the Fed's response? More debt. Let's blow a bigger bubble. And so the problem got worse. Now, once you've made the debt problem worse, once you've added more debt, see, the market solution would have been to eliminate debt, to allow defaults and bankruptcies, right, to get rid of the problem. But the Fed's solution was to make the problem bigger, but numb us to the pain, right, by, you know, drugging us back up again. So if the Fed did quantitative easing and blew up its balance sheet and made a bigger bubble, how was it ever going to reverse that? It couldn't. It was impossible for Bernanke to follow through with his promise, his commitment. Because if the Fed actually did what Bernanke said they were going to do, they would have created an even worse financial crisis than the one that they created in 2008, which is why they never did it. Now, eventually, yeah, they did try to shrink the balance sheet, but it wasn't for like a decade later where the Fed first started shrinking the balance sheet in like, what was it, 2017 or something like that, and they aborted it, 2018, or what, they started 2018, but they aborted it, and then, of course, when COVID hit, they, you know, ratcheted it right back up again. And now, yes, they're trying again to shrink the balance sheet. And it already really caused a financial crisis in 2023 rather, in March. And they put a Band-Aid on that. And the Band-Aid is starting to fall off. In fact, New York Community Bank, I remember the name this time, down another 22% today. You know, just today. I mean, the stock is now down at $4.20. It was a $12 stock like a week ago, you know, when they came out with this bad news. The 52-week high is $14.22, but this thing is collapsing. And this is the canary in a coal mine of problems in the banks. In fact, even Janet Yellen, I think, was testifying somewhere today, like acknowledging, like, there's some problems with commercial real estate and regional community banks. I mean, that is an understatement. There's not just some problems, right? This is a huge, huge problem that is blowing up. I mean, it already blew up, and they were able to kick the can down the road. But, you know, they're out of road come in March, and they're going to have to fess up. But they may not even make it, because I think as the March deadline gets closer, more problems are going to start to blow up. But what I wanted to point out by bringing this up is that Powell went on 60 Minutes and basically lied or demonstrated his own ignorance of the situation. And that really is the precedent that has been repeated every time a Fed chairman has been on 60 Minutes, including Jerome Powell's appearance over the weekend. Now, of course, one of the things he talked about on 60 Minutes was the thing he talks about at the press conference. He was basically doing an infomercial for the Biden administration, talking about how great the economy is. We got the strong economy. We got the strong labor market. Everything is great, right? That's A, not true. Because if everything was great, we wouldn't be having these massive budget deficits and trade deficits. We wouldn't be seeing debt exploding and savings imploding. We wouldn't be witnessing all these people holding multiple jobs, you know, record number of people forced into moonlighting. We wouldn't see all-time low. Biden's popularity sank again. The most recent numbers, all-time record low for his presidency, meaning the all-time record low for any president in the history of these polls. All this is happening because the economy is bad, but Powell is spinning it as if it were good, but also, you know, claiming victory over inflation. I mean, saying, look, you know, we've made a lot of progress. We think we've got the problem solved. We just want to make sure. right? Inflation has come down, but we just want to remain vigilant in case it rears its head again. Like we think we've won, but we don't want to declare victory just yet, right? We just want to make sure that everything is okay, when of course nothing is okay. But one of the other points was the debt, because at least the guy interviewing, again, I forget the name of these reporters, but he brought up the debt, the national debt, the $34.2 trillion elephant in the room. And he said, hey, you know, are you worried about the debt, right? This has got to be a problem, right? I mean, come on, right? This is a big deal. So at least they asked him about the debt, because that's something that they don't do when he has these press conferences, you know, like he did the prior week. All those reporters, and nobody asks him about the national debt. I mean, how can that be, right? I mean, that's got to be the biggest problem out there for the country and the Fed. And not just that we have the debt, but that it's now exploding exponentially, and we have this, you know, ticking bomb as all the short-term debt matures. Because remember, right, Janet Yellen, when she was asked about the debt, she said, well, it's not a problem as long as the interest rates are low, right? And I criticized her at the time because I said, okay, well, then it's a problem right now, because we know interest rates aren't going to stay low forever, and they didn't. And so now interest rates are at over 5%, and so it's a big problem. But of course, Janet Yellen doesn't talk about it now, that the very thing that she said that would make it a problem has happened, right? And now she's got to, I guess, get amnesia about it. But at least he was asked about it on his 60 Minutes appearance. But what Powell said was again, not true. Either it was a lie or the guy's, you know, just completely incompetent. But he said, yeah, I am worried about the national debt because we're on an unsustainable path. And that, yes, if we don't do something about it, well, it's going to be a problem for the future generations. You know, we're taxing, you know, borrowing from the future generations. And yes, you know, it's unsustainable and it's going to be a problem in the future for future generations, right? That's basically a way of saying it's not a problem right now. So none of you people who are watching 60 Minutes tonight have to worry. It's your grandkids, right, that they have to worry. So who cares, right? They'll figure out, right? I mean, that's what they always say. It's a problem for the future. It's not a problem for the future. This is not a long-term problem anymore. This is a short-term problem that could blow up any minute. It's this generation that's going to pay the piper, not some future generation. It's happening right now. Now, does that mean it's going to happen tomorrow? Well, it could, but it probably won't. But it's not 10 years away. It's probably not even 5 years away. But even if it was 10 years away, that's this generation, right? That's the people who are expecting to collect Social Security. These aren't your grandchildren. This is you. Right? This is us that are going to deal with this problem. And Jerome Powell shouldn't be worried about it because we're on an unsustainable path. He should be worried that we've already arrived at an unsustainable destination. Anyway, we got a second commercial, so stick around. I'll be right back.
Your business was humming, but now you're falling behind. Teams buried in manual work, taking forever to close the books. Getting one source of truth is like pulling teeth. If this is you, you should know these three numbers: 37,000, 25, and 1. 37,000. That's the number of businesses which have already upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, streamlining accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, and more. 25. NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less. Close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get customized solutions for all your KPIs, key performance indicators, in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need, and it's all in one place. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you constantly excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/gold. That's netsuite.com/gold to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/gold.
All right, I'm talking about Jerome Powell's 60-minute appearance. And, you know, I think he did a disservice to the nation in dismissing the significance and severity of the debt problem, admitting that we're on an unsustainable path and claiming that it's something future generations are going to have to deal with, lets everybody off the hook. What Powell should have said is this is a huge problem and you need to pressure your congressman to do something about it right now. We can't wait for the crisis. We have to preempt the crisis. As bad as it's going to be, waiting for the market to cause it is going to be even worse. We have to bring the crisis about under our own terms, kind of like a controlled burn to the extent you can even control it, rather than waiting for an uncontrollable wildfire to just develop. But no, he's not going to do that. He's a politician. He wants to pretend that everything is great to let the politicians off the hook from having to actually make any of the difficult political choices. And it's only difficult because it jeopardizes their reelection, right? It's not really difficult. I mean, doing the right thing is pretty easy, assuming you know what the right thing is. You just cast a vote. The reason it's so difficult is because these cowards in Washington don't want to risk losing the next election. You know, that's it. I mean, they won't even do that for their country. I mean, we've had people who have gone to war and have died for their country. Yet our elected leaders won't even risk losing an election for their country. I mean, how unpatriotic can you be? I mean, what's so horrible? I mean, so you lose the election, so you got to get a real job. I mean, that's not like dying, you know, in battle for your country. So it's a very small sacrifice that we're asking these guys to do. Just cast a principled vote for the good of the country. And they can't even do that, that one simple thing. Anyway, let me move on to the other interview that's on my mind. And that was the Donald Trump, Maria Bartiromo, Fox interview. And look, I mean, obviously, I want Trump over Biden. Trump is better than Biden, or Biden is worse than Trump, right? So if those are your choices, then Trump. And if I could vote, that's who I'd vote for. But I can't vote because I live in Puerto Rico, so I don't even have to make a decision, not that it's a difficult one. Although a lot of times I vote Libertarian because that's where my principles lie. And, you know, when I lived in Connecticut, yeah, you know, I usually voted Libertarian, except I did vote for Trump because, you know, nobody thought he could win. And I just, you know, I thought he was going to win. At least I wanted to be part of that. So I voted for him. And, I was hoping that he would actually do a lot more than he did. I was hoping that he would govern the way he ran, but he governed more like a politician. He ran more as a statesman, but that's not how he governed. But again, anything can happen in his second term, so, you know, you can always hope. But, again, he says things that I just, you know, really wish he would not say. Now, granted, some of it could just be, you know, campaigning, right? It's a good, you know, campaign strategy. But, you know, I got a problem with dishonesty. And although in Trump's mind, I mean, look, again, you know, it's not a lie if Trump believes it, right? So if Trump says something that's not true, it's not a lie if he believes it, right? So I'm talking about a couple of things in particular. One, of course, he talks about how great the economy was when he was president. Now, he talks about how lousy it is now. It's a disaster. It's awful. We're a nation in decline. We're in ruin. I mean, it's like, you know, everything is horrible, except 3 years ago when he was there, everything was fantastic. Not only was it fantastic, according to Donald Trump, the U.S. economy was never stronger in its history, in its 250-odd year history. The economy was never stronger ever than when he was president. And then he also said that we had never been doing as well as a country than during the time that he was president. I guess maybe he's talking about before COVID, right? Right during those 3 years, whatever it was, that it was the best it's ever been. Now, you got to have a real short memory or really not have any understanding of American history to believe that that was even close to being true. I mean, first of all, when Trump was president, even before COVID, the budget deficits were rising and the trade deficits were rising. So if you take those two signs, how could we have been this huge prosperous nation if we were bleeding red ink in international trade and our budget deficits? And also, manufacturing was continuing to decline during his presidency. So the trends that were in place before Trump entered office didn't change while he was in office. He inherited a bubble from Obama, and it got bigger under his watch. Now, does that mean he didn't do any good things while he was president? No, he did some good things on foreign policy. He did some good things on deregulation. He did some good appointments to the Supreme Court. So it wasn't a complete disaster, but he didn't make America great again. He didn't cut anything. He didn't cut government spending. In fact, in this Maria Bartiromo interview, he was bragging about having created the Space Force. The last thing we needed was a Space Force. You know, we were already broke from the stuff we're doing here on Earth. The last thing we needed to do is borrow more money to do more stuff in space that we can't afford. So he still didn't get that. He signed every spending increase. He increased military spending. He increased welfare spending. The government got bigger. Yes, we deregulated, which was good. We could have done a lot more of that. But the government spending went up. So the burden, I don't care that he cut taxes. Like Trump wants to brag about the big tax cuts. Those big tax cuts mean nothing if spending went up, if the deficits went up. Who does Donald Trump think is on the hook to pay those deficits? The taxpayers. So they got no relief. It is a sham. You cut taxes, but you increase spending. All you're doing is giving the taxpayer a bigger bill in the form of deficits that are going to be repaid with either higher taxes
or more inflation,
which is partially responsible for the high inflation that we have today. He's not totally responsible because there were presidents that went before him that are responsible, and Congress was responsible, and the Fed was responsible. So he's part of the problem, right? He's not part of the solution, at least not yet. I mean, if he does something completely different in his second term, well, maybe. So I'll reserve judgment until, you know, we actually see what he does. But so far, right, he is to blame because no government spending was cut. And when he talked on Bartiromo, he didn't mention anything he's going to cut. In fact, when he talked about inflation, the only thing he said, his whole plan to fight inflation is drill, baby, drill. That's it. Right. Three words. Drill, baby, drill. Now, yuck, I'm all for, you know, rolling back regulations on oil and gas. Yeah, let's drill more oil. Sure. Yeah, it's great. But that's not going to solve the problem. We don't have inflation because we didn't drill enough oil. We have inflation because we printed too much money. And we printed too much money because the government spent too much money. And that happened under Trump. And it's going to continue to happen under Trump unless we cut government spending. But so far, he doesn't want to cut Social Security, doesn't want to cut Medicare. He doesn't talk about anything that he wants to cut. And I understand you start talking about what you're going to cut, you start losing votes, right? But, you know, so maybe after he becomes president, he'll be able to start doing the things that he's afraid to talk about because he wants to get people's votes. Now, he did talk about raising taxes, though, interestingly enough, but only because he claims that Americans are going to have to pay him. He talked about raising taxes on the Chinese, tariffs. He said that he's going to impose tariffs. Now, Maria said, hey, we've heard that you might have 60% tariffs on Chinese goods. And he said, no, it could be more than 60%, right? You know, and he acted as if that this is a great thing, right? And that the Chinese are going to pay these tariffs. Well, the Chinese don't pay the tariffs. It's the Americans who buy Chinese products. They pay the tariffs, not the Chinese. Now, yes, the Chinese might hurt if, you know, they have lower sales, right? Their sales go down because their goods are a lot more expensive. So, yes, the president can do some damage to China with these tariffs, but the Chinese don't pay the tariffs. It's the Americans that pay the tariffs. Now, Americans could decide not to buy the Chinese goods, right? And they don't pay the tariffs, but now they buy other goods that were made in another country, maybe Indonesia, maybe Taiwan, you know, wherever, Mexico or some other country, right? They're not made in America because we don't make the stuff, right? So instead of buying from China, we buy from the next cheapest supplier, but it's still more expensive. And so if you don't buy a Chinese product and you end up buying an Indonesian product that's 20% cheaper than what the Chinese product would have been, but it's still cheaper than what the Chinese product is with the tariff, that difference is still being paid by the American consumer, who is forced to buy a more expensive product because the government put a tariff on the lower price product, artificially jacking up the price. Now, of course, when that happens, everybody loses, because at least when the American buys the Chinese good that's subject to the tariff, the U.S. government gets the money, right? So now that's a smaller deficit because the government collected the tax. But if an American switches from a Chinese product to another more expensive product, the U.S. government gets nothing. There's no tax there. But the American just pays more and the government gets nothing. So it's just a lose-lose for America. Now, look, I'm not necessarily against tariffs as a substitute for other forms of taxes. Like, tell the American public, hey, we're going to lower your payroll tax, we're going to lower your income tax, and we're going to replace it with a tariff. In fact, I mentioned this on this podcast, the way Congress and the president sold the American public on the income tax in the first place. The reason we even had a 16th Amendment, rather, is that the congressman told the voters, if we get an income tax, we can eliminate the tariffs, because everybody knew that the middle class and the poor paid the tariffs. And so the politicians said, hey, let's tax the rich. Let's tax Carnegie and Vanderbilt and Rockefeller, right? Let's tax those guys, and then we don't have to tax you with tariffs. So, you know, given the fiscal situation that we're in and given the state that our industry is in, tariffs might not be a bad way to raise revenue, but at least you got to level with the public that the people are paying those tariffs. But what we really need are not just tax increases. We need spending cuts. Americans pay a lot of taxes. We just don't pay a lot of taxes in relation to how much money the government spends. We have the biggest government in the history of the world, and it spends more money, and it doesn't collect nearly enough in taxes to cover that spending. That doesn't mean we're not paying enough taxes. It means they're spending too much. Now, yes, if we want all this government, then we better be prepared for much higher taxes or much higher prices and pay the inflation tax one way or another. But I think if most Americans realize what the choice was, either paying higher taxes or having less government, most people would accept less government. Except they just don't realize that they have to make that choice. They think they can have their cake and eat it too, right? They think there's a free lunch that the government is serving. When they realize how expensive the food is, they're not going to want to eat it anymore. Oh, and by the way, I mentioned, you know, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers, and, you know, these guys made their fortunes during the real heyday of the American economy, which was from, I guess, the end of the Civil War. So call it, you know, 1870-ish, you know, give me a few years for Reconstruction. But from 1870 until about the First World War, 1913 or 1916 was the First World War. The Federal Reserve was created in 1913. But that period of time, that was the Gilded Age. That was the boom. We've never seen economic growth anywhere close to that. Not even in the post-war period after the Second World War, the 1950s, which were clearly more prosperous than the Trump years. But the 1880s, the 1890s, the 1910s, the 1920s. I mean, we've never seen anything like it in my lifetime as far as the rise in the standard of living. that Americans had. I mean, that's when the economy was never doing better. That's when we lifted millions and millions of people out of poverty, not just from America, but from all around the world. Remember, all the immigrants were coming here, by the millions through Ellis Island and then going all around the country. That's when all four of my grandparents came here. We were eradicating poverty all over the world because people were moving to America for freedom and opportunity, not for government programs and handouts. But that's when we created all these, wealthy people, the robber barons. But the real wealth was the middle class, which came from nothing. I mean, we invented the middle class. There was no middle class in Europe. There was very poor and there was the rich. Middle class was an American phenomenon created by American capitalism. And so the standard of living of average people rose like never before. And we transformed the whole economy, right? In 1870, people were riding around on horses. They had candles. They had an outhouse. They didn't have indoor plumbing. But by 1916, when the war started, there was electricity. People had telephones. People had indoor plumbing. People had refrigeration. I mean, people had appliances. We were mass producing all these consumer goods, washing machines, vacuum cleaners. I mean, all kinds of stuff was invented. People had radio. I mean, life was completely transformed. The standard of living rose like no other period. So when Trump wants to talk about the fact that the U.S. economy has never done better in its history, he doesn't know American history. That's when it did the best. America did the best when the government governed the least, when government was an afterthought, when there were no income taxes, when there were no payroll taxes, when we had none of these programs, when government was tiny and lived within the confines of the Constitution, when we had sound money, when we had gold and silver as money, not all this fiat. That's when we did the best. I mean, the economy wasn't even the best of my lifetime when Trump was president, let alone the best in American history. Anyway, I want to finish up the podcast, though, by talking about what the SEC did. The news came out today. And, of course, no one's probably going to be talking about how bad this is on, your conventional news networks. I mean, they might talk about it, right? Oh, here's some new news coming out of the SEC, right? Without appreciating, how bad it is. But anyway, I talked about this over the summer. I mentioned that a friend of mine who lived out here in Puerto Rico had been sued by the SEC for trading securities without being a licensed security broker. He wasn't licensed by FINRA, right? And I talked about FINRA. I was with FINRA for 30 years, and I'm now FINRA free. But my friend was trading securities. And FINRA said, hey, you're trading securities and you're not a licensed security dealer. We're fining you millions and millions of dollars, right? Well, but my friend wasn't a broker-dealer. He traded exclusively for his own account. He had no customers. He was just trading his own money. What he used to do was he invested in companies. He loaned the money and he would generally do convertible notes where he can convert the debt into stock in the company and then he could take that stock and sell it. But it's his own money, right? The government said, oh no, you're a dealer, you're a security dealer and you should have been registered. And I pointed out that was complete farce because he's not a dealer because he doesn't have any customers. You see, the reason that we have these security regulation in 1934, after the Great Depression started, Roosevelt's president, the stock market crashed in 1929, and the government said, oh, look at all these people who lost money in the stock market. The government needs to protect them, right? That we need to have the SEC to protect the investors so they don't lose money in the stock market, right? Well, think about how many investors have lost money, in the stock market since the SEC. Now, the irony again, or this is how government works, the Federal Reserve caused the stock market crash. Well, they didn't cause the crash. They caused the bubble. And the bubble made the crash inevitable. And, if you want to read a short synopsis, read Alan Greenspan's Golden Economic Freedom. And he writes about how the Federal Reserve inflated the bubble in the late 1920s. So the Fed caused the stock market bubble. The bursting was inevitable. Yes, people lost money. They lose money in every bubble. And now the government says, oh, people lost money. We need more government. We need to create an entire agency to protect the public from these unscrupulous broker-dealers who are ripping them off. No, we need protection from government. We need protection from central bankers. The free market provides us protection from unscrupulous brokers. So we get the SEC that was started in 1934. But then it was worse. They amended that act in 1939 to create something worse than the SEC, and that was the National Association of Security Dealers, the NASD. And I originally became a member of the NASD in the 1980s. The NASD is what became FINRA in 2007, and it's still FINRA. But that was created again under FDR in 1939 to protect the public, because according to the government, we're all too stupid, right, to know a bad broker and to fire one, right? We can't have a free market. We can't have it caveat emptor. No. The public is too dumb to figure out who's a good stockbroker and who's a bad stockbroker. So we're going to have this government organization to regulate. But actually, FINRA or NASD was private. So they created a private organization. But then the government said, if you want to trade securities for a living for customers, if you want to charge commissions and you want to be a stockbroker, right, you want to make a market to the public, you got to be a member of this club. And if you're not, see, we can sue you. We can fine you, right? You can't be a stockbroker unless you join this club, which is why the whole thing was illegal, because so much of what FINRA does is unconstitutional. But the government say, well, we're not doing it. This is a private organization that's doing this. They can do what they want. They're private. They're not really private if the government requires you to be a member, right? That there's nothing private about that. Yes, if membership was voluntary, okay, but it's not voluntary. If you want to be a stockbroker, you got to be a member. And if you're not a member, well, you're going to get fined or sued or, you know, you go to jail. Well, what just happened? The SEC now ruled, and this is, you know, follows up on what was going on with my friend. They're now saying, and I don't have all the criteria, but they're basically saying that if you are trading in various markets or you're trading in certain dollar amounts, even if you're just a hedge fund trading your own money or your, you know, or you're a market maker or you're a prop trader, right? You're just trading for your own account or you're a group of people, you know, sophisticated people who have come together and have formed a fund, an investment vehicle, and you're trading for yourself, right? You're not charging anybody a fee. You're not making any money off the trade. See, that was the whole definition of a security dealer, security broker dealer, is you're getting paid. You are trading on behalf of a third party, and you are charging that third party a commission or a markup or some type of fee, right? And that's what made you a broker dealer. But now the SEC is saying, even if you have no customers at all, if you're just trading for yourself, we're going to consider you a broker dealer and we're going to regulate you. We're going to require you to become a member of FINRA, to join that club, to pay all their licensing fees, to follow all their rules, to be subject to their audits and all their fines and all that BS. And now they're saying more and more people have to be subject to this. But why? There's no customer to protect. If the whole purpose of the law was to protect the customer, who's unsophisticated mom and pop guy, from some greedy broker who is going to rip them off, what is the justification for this when there is no customer? It's just sophisticated people. Are they going to rip themselves off? The government has to protect you from yourself. The whole thing is ridiculous, apart from the fact that it's unconstitutional. But think about this. A law was passed. The act that created the SEC and FINRA, Congress passed this act. There was a vote, and a president had to sign it. A law was passed specifically to regulate broker-dealers. How can the SEC, nobody elected these guys, they just have a meeting, and they decide they're going to redefine what a broker-dealer is so that they can regulate something where there's been no legislation authorizing it. Congress has never voted on this. A president has never signed this. The whole thing is a violation of our due process. We're supposed to be a nation of laws, not a few men that work at the SEC just deciding to make laws by redefining words. Words have meaning. They can't change the meaning. I mean, what if Congress, you know, decided they were going to pass a tax on bananas, some kind of national excise tax on bananas? They voted for it, and the president signed it. And so there's a banana tax. And then you have the Commerce Department decides, you know, we're going to just define a banana as all fruit. Right? And they start imposing the tax on oranges, on apples, on grapes, on blueberries. I mean, how could they do that? The tax was on bananas, right? It's not on blueberries. You want to tax blueberries, go back and pass a new bill, right? Have everybody vote on it, right? So if Congress wants to regulate proprietary traders, right? Hedge funds that are trading for their own account, if they want to force a hedge fund to register with FINRA, then pass a new law, have a vote, right? Study it, have some committees, right? Debate it, and then have a president sign it. Follow the due process of our country. You just can't have these bureaucrats making law and making it, you know, retroactively too, because now they'll probably go back and say, hey, you should have been registered all along, right? Like that's what they did with my friend. They're trying to fine him from doing something that everybody thought was legal. And it was legal until they decided retroactively, like ex post facto, which is also unconstitutional. But all this is going to do, because it's going to go through because no one gives a damn. What is the effect of this? It's going to dramatically raise the cost of these proprietary traders and these hedge funds being in business. And so there'll be fewer of them. Some marginal guys will go away. And so what does that mean? That means there'll be less liquidity in these markets because these people trading for themselves actually provide liquidity to the market. Because they're there, average investors do a little bit better. They're not ripping off the investors. They are creating more liquidity. And so the liquidity is going to dry up. The cost of trading is going to go up. And everybody's going to hurt. You know, ironically, and I mentioned this on my last podcast, the little guy is already suffering because of FINRA and these complex rules and regulations. No broker dealers will work with the little guy. The little guy can't get an account at a full service brokerage firm. He can't meet the minimums. Why are those minimums there? Because the regulatory burden is so high that these firms can't afford to work with the very people that FINRA was created to protect, right? So they destroyed it. So those guys are already working on their own. And the fact that there's more liquidity and they can trade for free or practically, I mean, how can they be upset? Look at how low trading costs are right now, right? I mean, people are trading for nothing, right, at discount brokerage firms. But this is all government overreach. It's usurpation. It's the bureaucrats, the regulators making law. They're not there to make law. They're there to enforce the laws that Congress passes and that the president signs, and that's it. And what they're doing is illegal, it's unconstitutional, and nobody is going to talk about that except for me. Anyway, that's it for today. Again, if you like the video, make sure, if you know, give it a thumbs up, give it a like, leave me a comment. Again, don't forget to check me out live tomorrow on Laura Ingraham from 8 to 9 p.m. somewhere in there, Eastern time. Bye for now.